This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
$50 billion is an enormous amount of money. Bernie Madoff's going to spend the rest of his life in jail because of it. But even after today's guilty plea by the world's biggest Ponzi schemer, you have to riddle me this. Where did all that money go? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is the 12th of March. This one's a Thursday, and it's great to have you here. We knew going in that Bernie Madoff was going to plead guilty today. His attorney said as much earlier this week. Still, even though Madoff is behind bars tonight, the case isn't over by a long shot. Marketplace's Bob Moon reports there is still that matter of the missing $50 billion.
Investigators could start by asking, who got rich? Certainly Madoff did, but are there still billions hidden somewhere?
We're not sure yet. A true forensic accounting needs to be done.
Boston University professor Mitchell Zukov is the author of Ponzi's Scheme, The True Story of a Financial Legend.
Right now has accounted for about $1 billion, that doesn't rule out the possibility that there are secret accounts elsewhere if we really were talking about $60 billion or the number the government has put on this, $170 billion.
Investigators reportedly are looking into bank accounts held by Madoff's wife, and attorney Jerry Reisman says Madoff's sons got rich working for their father, whether or not they knew about his fraud.
But for those criminal acts, they would not have made this money.
Reisman represents 14 clients who lost a combined $150 million. He concedes it's likely little is left since Ponzi schemes work by taking money from later investors and paying it to earlier investors. Indeed, Reisman is preparing to defend some clients who were paid off by Madoff and now have to worry about so-called clawback lawsuits.
Many of them did receive tremendous amounts of payments over the years. In fact, we have clients who receive more money than they actually lost.
But tracking that money also won't be easy for the court-appointed receiver handling the case, so says investment attorney Tom Ajami.
Madoff's records are a complete mess and probably not to be believed since he's an admitted scam artist.
In the end, legal experts say the total real money actually invested in the scheme is likely to be considerably less than Madoff's own inflated accounting. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
No matter how much it was, if it's your money that Madoff took, it is very, very real. The focus so far has been on mostly the rich and powerful who got fleeced, but there were obviously thousands of others, maybe more than that. Like Cynthia Friedman and her husband, she tried to put it in perspective today outside the courthouse in New York.
We never met the man personally, but my husband's a CPA, so very wealthy clients had been invested with him since like 1985. So my father-in-law and my husband were told, you know, you should really get your money in with Bernie Madoff. And, of course, then you had to ask people to do you a favor by speaking to Mr. Madoff and you know, getting you in. And we were so lucky that he accepted us.
Laughing, I think, so she doesn't cry, the judge set Madoff's sentencing today for June the 16th. The White House is trying to cool a growing spat with Europe. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner leaves tonight for a big meeting outside London this weekend. Finance ministers from the world's 20 biggest economies are trying to lay the groundwork for when their bosses get together next month. There is still, though, some disagreement over what exactly economic stimulus is. From the Marketplace European Desk in London, Stephen Beard reports.
Germany insists that it's not been tight-fisted in doling out stimulus money. That perception, the Germans say, ignores the fact they have a far more generous welfare system than America. As Germany slides deeper into recession, its government automatically pays out more in unemployment benefits than the US. The so-called stabilizers provide an automatic boost for the German economy. Stefan Richter is with the online magazine The Globalist. He says the IMF looked at the figures and the Germans are right.
They said there's an insignificant difference in the stimulus package between Germany and the U.S. for 2009. And in fact, in 2010, because of these automatic stabilizers, the German package is going to be a little larger than the U.S. package.
German analysts also point out that the worst of the economic crisis has yet to hit Europe, and the problems ahead could be huge. Bankruptcy is looming for some of the former communist countries in the East, like Hungary. Germany is right to save for that rainy day, says commentator Heinz Schult.
At the end of the day, somebody has to underwrite the debts of the new members of the European Union, and that would be the engine of European economic progress, which is Germany.
He says the Germans may also have to bail out the Eurozone as countries like Ireland and Greece threaten to default on their debts. Pretty soon, he says, Germany will be the most stimulating place on the planet. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
I understand how sick and tired you are of hearing about banks, and please believe me when I tell you you're not the only ones. That's why we're not going to talk about banks that are in trouble today. Let's make it, well, I don't know, life insurers instead. They're facing many of the same problems that banks are, and at least a dozen of them are hoping they too might soon be in line for some help from the U.S. Treasury. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports now on what could be the next big bailout.
Life insurance companies have icons like noble stags or giant boulders.
Prudential. Let Prudential be your rock.
So going to the federal government and asking for a handout is a bit of a come down. But Don Vickery with Gradient Analytics says some companies like Prudential doubled their debt during the boom.
And they've used those borrowed funds to invest in riskier and riskier assets.
Now, just like banks, insurers have watched the value of these assets decline. Vickery says it's unlikely any big firms are headed for disaster, but the hit insurers have taken is rippling through the economy.
We are the largest purchaser of corporate bonds.
Frank Keating heads the American Council of Life Insurers. He says his industry supplies almost one out of every $5 companies borrow.
But unfortunately, in the fourth quarter of 2008, we only purchased $3.3 billion in stocks and bonds. That's a 63% drop.
Instead of lending to businesses right now, many big insurers are hoarding their cash. That's a drag on the economy. And last fall, a dozen large insurers applied for money from the Troubled Asset Relief Fund. They've been left dangling.
Is it a matter of panic? No. Is it a matter of some disquiet? Yes.
Keating, an industry lobbyist, says giving TARP money to insurers would be great for the economy. Vickery says it would be a great thing for these companies' shareholders. But even without a bailout, policyholders are probably safe. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Speaking of shareholders, make of this what you will, but as of today, it's three winners in a row on Wall Street. We will have the details when we do the numbers. If you want to get a hold of me during working hours, you can call my office. After that, you can get me at home. I've got my cell phone with me almost all the time, too, unless I'm in the radio studio. It's convenient, I guess, if you don't mind trying three different 10-digit numbers. Or you could have me sign on for Google's latest offering in its quest for world domination. David Pogue did a write-up of the company's new voice product in the New York Times this morning. David, good to have you with us.
Thanks so much.
So here we are. Google has launched yet another revolutionizing product here. What is this thing?
So it's called Google Voice, and it started life 2 years ago as a startup called Grand Central. Google bought it, and all the Grand Central fans thought Google then left it for dead because there's not a word about it, no enhancements for 2 years. And then today they shocked everybody by unveiling a much enhanced version.
So in like 30 seconds or less, what does it do for you?
Basically, it transforms your phone. It turns voice messages and text messages into far more useful entities. And it starts by issuing you a new phone number. That's the downside. You get a new phone number that you distribute to everyone you know. But when they call that, all your phones ring at once. Your cell phone, your home phone, your work phone, your yacht phone. So we get out of that ridiculous thing about, oh, I tried you on your cell, now I'll try you at home. I mean, that thing is over. And what this also means is that you get a single unified voicemail box that's everywhere. It's on the web. It's on your cell phone. It's in your email. And what I mean by that is they actually transcribe voicemail messages left for you into text.
Huh. So as I understand it, no ads for now on Google Voice, right?
No ads and no plans to make any. They are able to support the entire thing from another feature I haven't even mentioned, which is from any phone, if you dial your own Google Voice number, you get these options. And one of them is press 2 to place a call. Calls in the United States are free. So this means that you could pick up your home phone and make free long-distance calls. Calls to international locations are very cheap. They're like 2 cents a minute, 3 cents a minute, depending on the country.
So this is voice over internet, right?
It is. That's right.
Then what does that mean for companies that already do voice over internet, like Skype, which has built a booming business?
I don't think I would like to be one of the companies in the way of Google Voice right now. So there, for example, there are companies that, as you say, do Skype-ish things and connect your long-distance calls for very cheap. There are companies that turn your voicemails into transcribed text. All of these companies are going to have to, you know, sweat it. They're going to have to get better or die.
Now that everybody's all excited about this thing, though, we should say you can't get it yet.
The several hundred thousand people who were Grand Central members for the last 2 years are all being offered today the chance to upgrade to the new service. If you've never been part of Grand Central, they say it's going to be a matter of weeks while they work out the kinks for this upgrading process and then start offering these new phone numbers.
It all sounds great, but doesn't it somehow strike you as just a little too much to deal with for one simple phone call?
Yes. I'm sure there's a downside to all this somewhere. Complexity is one. But obviously, this is for people who already feel like all these phones are too complex. And another one that I'm hearing a lot from my readers of my Times column this morning is, what about privacy? Isn't Google now having too much power? Aren't they now listening into our messages? Blah, blah, blah. To which I say, dude, if you're going to worry about that, it's way too late. How do you know Verizon and AT&T and Sprint aren't listening into your messages right now? They could all be listening to your messages. You'll never know.
David Pogue writes a tech column for the New York Times. David, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
As the economy continues to shrink, and despite the billions that are in the stimulus plan, state governments are scrambling to find any spare change they can. They're making budget cuts across dozens of different programs. And science and technology have been hit as hard as anything else has. That means the institutions that do a lot of that kind of research, public and private universities, are having to do without now. And it's raising the possibility that breakthroughs that might actually stimulate the economy are going to be shoved to the back burner. Janet Babin reports now from the Marketplace Innovations Desk at North Carolina Public Radio.
There's a very good chance that even now, as I'm talking to you, there's a graduate student in some basement research lab on the brink of the next big thing. Rich Superfine at the University of North Carolina likes to imagine it will come from one of his postdocs.
Down here is the laboratory where we do the experiments on the cilia mimics.
Superfine's team has developed artificial cilia. Wow, they mimic the tiny fibers in your windpipe that protect your lungs. Ben Evans shows them off.
So these are the human lung cilia, and these are artificial cilia.
You know what? The real cilia are really beautiful, and your cilia, not so.
Not so beautiful? We think they're absolutely.
What they lack in beauty, they make up for in utility. The fake cilia could have commercial uses in water filtration systems or in artificial lungs, and potential collaborators are interested. But what Superfine's team needs, besides more funding, of course, are deal makers.
We need a way to get technologies from the laboratory ready to show real market potential. I mean, you need people who are paying attention to it, not from the standpoint of writing a research paper, but you need real technology development people.
That's the aim of a planned 80,000-square-foot innovation center on UNC's Chapel Hill campus. The center would help Superfine's technology jump the gap from research paper to commercialization. Except it's not happening. Before construction began, the building's private developer ran into financial problems. Then the state put the project on hold. Similar delays are happening across the country. MIT has said it will cut at least $50 million from next year's budget because of falling endowments. New York State's technology cuts will reach into the billions. At the University of Michigan, the Tech Transfer Office budget will take a 3% hit this year. tech transfer offices match researchers with entrepreneurs. Ken Nispitz, the executive director.
We will definitely feel it, but we're not going to stop the work we have, and we'll figure out a way to leverage the resources we have as effectively as we can.
Last year, U of M's tech transfer office created 13 new startup companies, mainly funded by venture capitalists. One of them builds next-generation battery systems for hybrid and electric cars. But Nispitz says this year is a lot more challenging.
Some of our companies that we've been working with have had to stop projects because of either funding difficulties or just uncertainty. So we've lost a few deals this year already.
With state and private funds disappearing, many scientists think the federal government should step up and put more money into university research. Rich Superfine at UNC says that would keep university incubators running.
If you look at one place where you're going to funnel money, it's got to go into innovation. It's got to be the next generation of companies. Because in the long run, that's where the money is going to pay off.
The new stimulus package includes more money for scientific research. But with so many more outstretched hands, those funds won't go as far around the lab as they used to. In Chapel Hill, North Carolina, I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Coming up, the money trail behind America's favorite party drug.
It's a pill that has the chemical qualities of mescaline and methamphetamine, but it's not really a hallucinogen, and it creates this sort of euphoric high in the users.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials jumped 239 points today, 3.4% to close at 7,170. The NASDAQ climbed 54 points, that is 3.9%, ended the day at 1426. The S&P 500 grabbed 29 points, 4%, wrapped up at 750. Retail sales for February were higher than expected. That gave those shares a boost. Walmart rang up 3%. The Gap dressed up 5.3%. Macy's joined the parade with a 6% gain. A credit downgrade didn't hold down General Electric shares. They lit up more than 12% today. Bank of America deposited more than 18%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note slipped to 2.8%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD. Keep an eye on Marketplace wherever you go. iPhone users can listen to business news and updates on fallout from the financial crisis, watch the Marketplace whiteboards, and follow the Scratchpad blog. Just visit Marketplace.org on your iPhone.
Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on international trade for January. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce holds a space economy symposium. The agenda looks at the role of interplanetary space in economic growth. And William H. Macy celebrates his birthday. The actor, well known for roles in numerous films, including Fargo, will be 59. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
We get comments one way or another about almost everything that airs on this program, but far and away it's our commentaries that get the most listener reaction, both pro and con, and as in the most recent example, corrective. Last week we heard from David Frum about the economic benefits of the president's stimulus package. The multiplier effect is what that's called. A lot of you wrote to disagree with his opinion, and that happens not infrequently. But a lot of you, like, say, Nicholas Bottaferrano from Notre Dame, Indiana, took us to task for not checking our facts more carefully.
David Frum's commentary repeated a divisive fallacy that is echoing around the national debate about the economic stimulus package. He claimed that it provides funding for a high-speed rail line from Las Vegas to Disneyland. This is patently untrue. The nonpartisan website factcheck.org debunks this rumor.
We checked as well, page number 237 of the stimulus package, if you're reading along. There is money in the plan for high-speed rail, $8 billion to be precise. Nothing, though, about a route from Disneyland to Vegas or any other route. There is a proposal out there for a high-speed train from Vegas to somewhere in Southern California. It's just not part of the stimulus plan. Moving right along, Chris Richter wrote about last week's Business of Sports interview with Diana Nyad.
The piece seemed to suggest taxpayers did not foot any of the bill for coaches' salaries. My alma mater, the University of South Carolina, pays its head football coach a salary of $257,500 a year. The same goes for the men's head basketball coach, who draws a $250,000 salary from the state.
Diana was talking specifically, though, about the University of Connecticut, so we called them. The university controller told us UConn basketball coach Jim Calhoun's salary is paid by the athletic department, and that department raises its own revenues from ticket sales, endorsements, boosters, and others. We've got a call in to the University of South Carolina to ask them about Mr. Richter's point. They haven't called us back yet. Finally this week, trucks. Sadie Babbitts reported on a proposal by the trucking industry to let bigger rigs on the road, presumably saving time, money, and fuel. Like Kay Bridges of Sausalito, California, a lot of you had a better idea.
There is a great way to ship more than one trailer of goods at a time with no additional congestion on the roads. It's called the train. Help cut pollution and take cars off the roads. Ship by rail.
Whether you're listening in your truck or on the train or on a boat or in a plane, we would like to hear from you somehow. Go to our website. It's marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. There are fundamentally two ways to make a business bigger. You can keep on coming up with and pumping out new products, boost your market share, and grow that way. Or you can pull out your checkbook and buy your way in. The pharmaceutical industry seems to be gravitating toward option B. Today, the Swiss drug maker Roche went that way. It bought up the U.S. biotech giant Genentech in a deal worth $47 billion, as Marketplace's Sam Eaton reports.
First, there was Pfizer's $68 billion buyout of Wyeth. Then Merck announced plans to buy Shearing Plough for $41 billion. Cap that with today's news of the Roche-Genentech deal and big pharma buyouts are officially a trend. T. Rowe Price analyst Jay Markowitz says there's good reason.
The most difficult thing to do in the pharmaceutical business is innovate.
And with highly profitable drugs like Lipitor, Plavix, and Zyprexa set to go generic over the next few years, the revenues from past innovations are fast approaching their expiration dates.
So without being able to come up with new drugs, companies have gone to Plan B, which is to try to mitigate the loss of those revenues through consolidation.
That way they keep the pipeline full with existing drugs while they develop new ones. And this is where not all deals are created equal. Miller Tabak analyst Les Funtleiter says today's Roche-Genentech deal has something the previous mergers don't. Access to cutting-edge research on cancer drugs, which are expected to be highly profitable in the coming years. Funtleiter says cancer drugs also tend to be approved quickly.
You get less pushback for a cure for cancer or a treatment for cancer than you would, say, for the fourth erectile dysfunction pill.
But the strategy can be risky. Acquisitions can rattle R&D departments, potentially driving away their most valuable assets. The scientists who work there. I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
Even though the Obama administration's not using the phrase the war on drugs, it has just appointed a new drug czar. The police chief out of Seattle, Washington, got the job yesterday. And when you think about what he's going to be going after, it's probably the biggies that come to mind. Heroin, methamphetamines, and cocaine, probably. Ecstasy, probably not. It's a tiny little pill, easy to transport and easy to consume. It delivers a huge high for its users and even bigger profits for its dealers. Lisa Sweetingham writes about the rise of America's favorite party drug and how the DEA tried to bring it down in her new book. It's called Chemical Cowboys. Lisa, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
We have to start, I guess, at the most basic building block of this whole thing. Remind us what ecstasy is.
Right. Well, it's a pill that has the chemical qualities of mescaline and methamphetamine, but it's not really a hallucinogen, and it creates this sort of euphoric high in the users.
And those users are?
Mostly youth. In the mid-90s to late 90s, it was really like 18 to 25 partiers, clubgoers, ravers.
Where? Was it all over the country?
It was in the party triangle.
A phrase I'm not familiar with, actually.
It's a very popular phrase among drug enforcement. The party triangle is Miami, New York, and Los Angeles, because that's where the pills were being brought in by mules and shipped to the different, like, night scenes.
Where were they coming from, these pills? I mean, tell us the background of this story.
Israeli organized crime dominated the trafficking of the pills, but the pills weren't coming from Israel. They were made in the Netherlands. They were made in clandestine labs in Belgium and around the southern part of the Netherlands. And Israeli expats who were involved in drug trafficking realized that they couldn't infiltrate the cocaine or the heroin trade. Those were entrenched in the drug cartels of Central and South America. But nobody was looking at ecstasy. Ecstasy among law enforcement was called kiddie dope. And the demand for ecstasy in America was phenomenal. And these little pills that were like maybe anywhere from a nickel to a quarter to make could fetch like up to $25 to $50 in a nightclub.
So when did the DEA really start cracking down on this? And how long did it take them to get a handle on this trade?
I think in 1999, essentially, when they found a dead body in the trunk of a Lexus in Brentwood, they realized that this was a pretty dangerous drug and they needed to take a closer look at it.
Out here on the west side of Los Angeles.
That's right. Yeah. And they tried to get a handle on who was in charge and what was going on. And that was when they realized that this one man, Oded Tweedo, was responsible for about 80% of the entire ecstasy supply in the United States. The agent that I follow in the book, Bob Gagne, he was obsessed with bringing Tweedo down, and he really worked a lot with the Dutch police and the Israeli police to try to winnow down his networks. And it took, though, many, many years, and it took law enforcement around the world to come together to do it.
Whatever happens to Oded Tweedo?
Well, I can tell you that he was finally captured, but you'll have to read the book to find out what happens to him, because it's really part of the ending.
Is this story, though, a success story for the DEA and for this effort to crack down on this drug?
Well, you know, that's a great question. Is it? And the agents that I spoke to, they won't take credit for it. They won't say it. But the former dealers who I spoke to, and people on both sides of the law, really, pretty much confirmed to me that Israelis have abandoned the trade. All of these high-profile arrests and all the seizures made it difficult for them. However, you know how it works. Once one group gets out, another group comes in. And so now what we're seeing is Asian drug trafficking organizations that are no longer making the drugs in Amsterdam, but they're making them in Canada. And they're bringing in these precursor chemicals from China. They're shipping them in. And they're actually mixing the drugs with methamphetamine. And if it's got meth in it, it's like a nice cheap filler. It's easier for them to make. And it also is much more addictive, which means they'll have more customers.
The book by Lisa Sweetingham about the ecstasy trade is called Chemical Cowboys. Lisa, thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, a postscript of sorts about U.S. Airways pilot Chesley Sullenberger. He's the one who put that airplane down in the Hudson River a couple of months ago, saved everybody on board. He's going to write a book, a memoir. Somewhere between $2.5 and $3 million is the advance. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Thursday afternoon. Today, the Dow jumped 239 points, 3.4%, closed at 7,170. The NASDAQ climbed up 54 points, 3.9%, settled at 1426. The S&P 500 gained 29 points, 4%, wrapped up at 750 on the nose. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is a guy named George Judson. Coming up next time on the program, Bear Stearns, 1 year later.
It still hurts to see that go. It sets you back, but, you know, it's certainly not devastation, which I'm sure that some other people went through.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media. All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.